Of Hatham's four companions, two were lesser light eyes, and one was a short, white-robed ardent. Dalinar didn't know. The last was a red-gloved Natten man, with bluish skin and stark white hair, two locks dyed a deep red, and braided down to hang alongside his cheeks. He was a visiting dignitary. Dalinar had seen him at the feasts. What was his name again?
"Tell me, Bright Lord Dalinar," Hatham said, "have you been paying much attention to the conflict between the Tukari and the Imuli?"
"It's a religious conflict, isn't it?" Dalinar asked. Both were Makabaki kingdoms on the southern coast where trade was plentiful and profitable.
"Religious," the Natten man said. "No, I wouldn't say that. All conflicts are essentially economic in nature."
"Awnak," Dalinar recalled. "That's his name." He spoke with an airy accent, overextending all of his ah and o sounds.
"Money is behind every war," Awnak continued. "Religion is but an excuse, or perhaps a justification."
"There's a difference," the Ardent said, obviously taking offense at Onak's tone.
"Of course," Awnak said. "An excuse is what you make after the deed is done, while a justification is what you offer before."
"I would say an excuse is something you claim but do not believe, Nak Ali."
Hatham was using the high form of Onak's name.
"While a justification is something you actually believe."
Why such respect? The Nat must have something that Hatham wanted.
"Regardless," Onak said, "this particular war is over the city of Sesamelek's Dar, which the Imuli have made their capital. It's an excellent trade city, and the Tukari want it."
"I've heard of Sesamelek's Dar," Dalinar said, rubbing his chin. "The city is quite spectacular, filling rifts cut into the stone."
"Indeed," Onak said. "There's a particular composition of the stone there that lets water drain. The design is amazing. It's obviously one of the Dawn cities."
"My wife would have something to say on that," Hatham said. "She makes the Dawn cities her study." "The city's pattern is central to the Imuli religion," the Ardent said. "They claim it is their ancestral homeland, a gift to them from the heralds, and the Tukari are led by that god-priest of theirs, Tezim. So the conflict is religious in nature."
"And if the city weren't such a fantastic port," Onak said, "would they be as persistent about proclaiming the city's religious significance?" "I think not. They're pagans, after all, so we can't presume their religion has any real importance."
Talk of the Dawn cities had been popular lately among the Light Eyes, the idea that certain cities could trace their origins back to the Dawn Singers. "Perhaps. Have any of you heard of a place known as Favorstone Keep?" Dalinar asked. The others shook their heads. Even Awnak had nothing to say.
"Why?"
Hatham asked.
"Just curious."
The conversation continued, though Dalinar let his attention wander back toward Elokar and his circle of attendants. When would Satius make his announcement? If he intended to suggest that Dalinar be arrested, he wouldn't do it at a feast, would he? Dalinar forced his attention back to the conversation. He really should pay more heed to what was happening in the world. Once, news of which kingdoms were in conflict had fascinated him. So much had changed since the visions began.
"Perhaps it's not economic or religious in nature," Hatham said, trying to bring an end to the argument. "Everyone knows that the Makabaki tribes have odd hatreds of one another."
"Perhaps," Awnak said.
"Does it matter?" Dalinar asked. The others turned to him.
"It's just another war. If they weren't fighting one another, they'd find others to attack. It's what we do. Vengeance, honor, riches, religion. The reasons all just produce the same result."
The others fell still, the silence quickly growing awkward.
Which devotary do you credit Bright Lord Dalinar?
Hatham asked, thoughtful, as if trying to remember something he'd forgotten.
The Order of Telenalot.
Ah,
Hatham said.
Yes, it makes sense. They do hate arguing over religion. You must find this discussion terribly boring.
A safe out from the conversation. Dalinar smiled, nodding in thanks to Hatham's politeness.
The Order of Telenalot, Onak said. I've always considered that a devotary for the lesser people.
This from a Natan, the Arden said stuffily.
My family has always been devoutly Vorin.
Yes, the Arden replied. Conveniently so, since your family has used its Vorin ties to trade favorably in Alethkar. One wonders if you are equally devout when not standing on our soil.
I don't have to be insulted like this, Onak snapped.
He turned and strode away, causing Hatham to raise a hand.
Nak Ali,
Hatham called, rushing after him anxiously.
Please, ignore him.
Insufferable bore, the Arden said softly, taking a sip of his wine. Orange, of course, as he was a man of the clergy. Dalinar frowned at him.
You are bold, Ardent, he said sternly. Perhaps foolishly so. You insult a man Hatham wants to do business with.
Actually, I belong to Bright Lord Hatham, the Ardent said. He asked me to insult his guest. Bright Lord Hatham wants Onak to think that he is shamed. Now when Hatham agrees quickly to Onak's demands, the foreigner will assume it was because of this, and won't delay the contract signing out of suspicion that it is proceeding too easily.
Ah, of course.
Dalinar looked after the fleeing pair. They go to such lengths. Considering that, what was Dalinar to think of Hatham's politeness earlier, when he had given Dalinar a reason to explain his apparent distaste for conflict? Was Hatham preparing Dalinar for some covert manipulation? The Ardent cleared his throat.
I would appreciate it if you did not repeat to anyone what I just told you, Bright Lord.
Dalinar noticed Adolin returning to the King's Island, accompanied by 6 of Dalinar's officers in uniform and wearing their swords.
Why did you tell me in the first place, then?
Dalinar asked, turning his attention back to the white-robed man.
Just as Hatham wishes his partner in negotiations to know of his goodwill, I wish you to know of our goodwill toward you, Bright Lord.
Dalinar frowned. He'd never had much to do with the Ardens. His devotary was simple and straightforward. Dalinar got his fill of politics with the court. He had little desire to find more in religion.
Why? What should it matter if I have goodwill toward you?
The Arden smiled.
We will speak with you again.
He bowed low and withdrew. Dalinar was about to demand more, but Adolin arrived, looking after High Prince Hatham.
What was that all about?
Dalinar just shook his head.
Ardents weren't supposed to engage in politics, whatever their devotary. They'd been officially forbidden to do so since the hierocracy.
But, as with most things in life, the ideal and the reality were two separate things. The Lydais couldn't help but use the Ardents in their schemes, and so, more and more, the devotaries found themselves a part of the court.
Father? Adolin asked.
The men are in place.
Good, Dalinar said. He set his jaw and then crossed the small island. He would see this fiasco finished with once and for all. He passed the fire pit, a wave of dense heat making the left side of his face prickle with sweat, while the right side was still chilled by the autumn cold. Adolin hurried up to walk by him, hand on his side sword.
Father, what are we doing?
Being proactive,
Dalinar said, striding right up to where Elokar and Satius were chatting. Their crowd of sycophants reluctantly parted for Dalinar.
And I think that...
The king cut off, glancing at Dalinar.
Yes, uncle?
Satius, Dalinar said,
What is the status of your investigation of the cut girth strap?
Satius blinked. He held a cup of violet wine in his right hand, his long red velvet robe open at the front to expose a ruffled white shirt.
Dalinar, are you...
Your investigation, Satius, Dalinar said firmly. Satius sighed, looking at Elokar.
Your Majesty, I was actually planning to make an announcement regarding this very subject tonight. I was going to wait until later. But if Dalinar is going to be so insistent...
I am, Dalinar said.
Oh, go ahead, Satius, the king said. You have me curious now.
The king waved to a servant who rushed to quiet the flutist, while another servant tapped the chimes to call for silence. In moments, the people on the island stilled. Satius gave Dalinar a grimace that somehow conveyed the message, "You demanded this, old friend." Dalinar folded his arms, keeping his gaze fixed on Satius. His 6 cobalt guardsmen stepped up behind him, and Dalinar noticed that a group of similar light-eyed officers from Satius's war camp were listening nearby.
Well, I wasn't planning to have such an audience, Satius said. Mostly this was planned for your majesty only.
Unlikely, Dalinar thought, trying to suppress his anxiety. What would he do if Adolin was right and Satius charged him with trying to assassinate Elokar? It would indeed be the end of Alethkar. Dalinar would not go quietly and the war camps would turn against one another. The nervous peace that had held them together for the last decade would come to an end. Elokar would never be able to hold them together. Also, if it turned to battle, Dalinar would not fare well. The others were alienated from him. He'd have enough trouble facing Satius. If several of the others joined against him, he would fall, horribly outnumbered. He could see how Adolin thought it an incredible act of foolishness to have listened to the visions. And yet, in a powerfully surreal moment, Dalinar felt that he'd done the correct thing. He'd never felt it as strongly as he had at that moment, preparing to be condemned.
"Satius, don't weary me with your sense of drama," Elokar said. "They're listening, I'm listening. Dalinar looks like he's ready to burst a vein in his forehead. Speak."
"Very well," Satius said, giving his wine to a servant. "My very first task as High Prince of Information was to discover the true nature of the attempt on His Majesty's life during the Great Shell Hunt."
He waved a hand, motioning to one of his men, who hurried away. Another stepped forward, handing Satius the broken leather strap.
"I took this strap to 3 separate leather workers in 3 different war camps. Each came to the same conclusion. It was cut. The leather is relatively new and has been well cared for, as proven by the lack of cracking and flaking in other areas. The tear is too even. Someone slit it."
Dalinar felt a sense of dread. That was near what he had discovered, but it was presented in the worst possible light.
"For what purpose?"
Dalinar began. Satius held up a hand.
"Please, High Prince. First you demand I report, then you interrupt me?"
Dalinar fell still. Around them, more and more of the important light eyes were gathering. He could sense their tension.
"But when was it cut?"
Satius said, turning to address the crowd. He did have a flair for the dramatic.
"That was pivotal, you see. I took leave to interview numerous men who were on that hunt. None reported seeing anything specific, though all remembered that there was one odd event. The time when Brightlord Dalinar and His Majesty raced to a rock formation. A time when Dalinar and the king were alone."
There were whispers from behind.
"There was a problem, however," Satius said. "One Dalinar himself raised. Why cut the strap on a shardbearer's saddle? A foolish move. A horseback fall wouldn't be of much danger to a man wearing shard plate."
To the side, the servant Satius had sent away returned, leading a youth with sandy hair bearing only a few hints of black. Satius fished something out of a pouch at his waist, holding it up. a large sapphire. It wasn't infused. In fact, looking closely, Dalinar could see that it was cracked. It wouldn't hold Stormlight now.
"The question drove me to investigate the king's shard plate," Satius said. 8 of the 10 sapphires used to infuse his plate were cracked following the battle."
"It happens," Adolin said, stepping up beside Dalinar, hand on his side sword. "You lose a few in every battle."
"But 8, Satius asked. 1 or 2 is normal. But have you ever lost 8 in one battle before, young Colin?"
Adolin's only reply was a glare. Satius tucked away the gemstone, nodding to the youth his men had brought.
"This is one of the grooms in the king's employ. Finn, isn't it?"
Yes, Bright Lord,
the boy stammered. He couldn't be older than 12.
"What is it you told me earlier, Finn? Please, say it again so that all may hear."
The dark-eyed youth cringed, looking sick.
"Well, Bright Lord, sir, it was just this. Everyone spoke of the saddle being checked over in Bright Lord Dalinar's camp. And I suppose it was, right as that. But I'm the one who prepared His Majesty's horse afore it was turned over to Bright Lord Dalinar's men. And I did it. I promise I did. Put on his favorite saddle and everything. But..."
Dalinar's heart raced. He had to hold himself back from summoning his blade.
"But what?"
Satius said to Finn.
"But when the king's head grooms took the horse past on its way to the High Prince Dalinar's camp, it was wearing a different saddle. I swear it."
Several of those standing around them seemed confused by this admission.
"Aha,"
Adolin said, pointing.
"But that happened in the king's palace complex."
"Indeed,"
Satius said, raising an eyebrow at Adolin.
"How keen-minded of you, young Colin. This discovery, mixed with the cracked gemstones, means something. I suspect that whoever attempted to kill His Majesty planted in his shard plate flawed gemstones that would crack when strained, losing their stormlight. Then they weakened the saddle girth with a careful slit. The hope would be that His Majesty would fall while fighting a great shell, allowing it to attack him. The gemstones would fail, the plate would break, and His Majesty would fall to an accident while hunting."
Satius raised a finger as the crowd began to whisper again.
"However, it is important to realize that these events, the switching of the saddle or the planting of the gemstones, must have happened before His Majesty met up with Dalinar. I feel that Dalinar is a very unlikely suspect. In fact, my present guess is that the culprit is someone that Bright Lord Dalinar has offended. That someone wanted us all to think he might be involved. It may not have actually been intended to kill His Majesty, just to cast suspicion upon Dalinar."
The island fell silent, even the whispers dying. Dalinar stood stunned.
I was right.
Adolin finally broke the quiet.
What?
All evidence points to your father being innocent, Adolin,
Satius said sufferingly.
You find this surprising?
No, but...
Adolin's brow furrowed. Around them, the light eyes began talking, sounding disappointed. They began to disperse. Dalinar's officers remained standing behind him as if expecting a surprise strike.
Blood of my fathers,
Dalinar thought.
What does it mean?
Satius waved for his men to take the groom away, then nodded to Elokar and withdrew in the direction of the evening trays, where warmed wine sat in pitchers next to toasted breads. Dalinar caught up to Satius as the shorter man was filling a small plate. Dalinar took him by the arm, the fabric of Satius's robe soft beneath his fingers. Satius looked at him, raising an eyebrow.
Thank you,
Dalinar said quietly,
for not going through with it.
Behind them,
The flutist resumed her playing.
"For not going through with what?"
Sadeus said, setting down his small plate, then prying Dalinar's fingers free.
"I had hoped to make this presentation after I'd discovered more concrete proof that you weren't involved. Unfortunately, pressed as I was, the best I could do was to indicate that it was unlikely you were involved. There will still be rumors, I'm afraid."
"Wait. You wanted to prove me innocent?" Sadeus scowled, picking up his plate again.
"Do you know what your problem is, Dalinar? Why everyone has begun finding you so tiresome?"
Dalinar didn't reply.
"The presumption. You've grown despicably self-righteous." "Yes, I asked Elikar for this position so I could prove you innocent. Is it so storming difficult for you to believe someone else in this army might do something honest?"
"Aye," Dalinar said.
"Of course it is," Sadeus said. "You've been looking down on us like a man standing atop a single sheet of paper who therefore thinks himself so high as to see for miles. Well, I think that book of Gavilar's is creme, and the codes are lies people pretended to follow so that they could justify their shriveled consciences. Damnation, I've got one of those shriveled consciences myself. But I didn't want to see you maligned for this bungled attempt to kill the king. If you'd wanted him dead, you'd have just burned out his eyes and been done with it."
Sadeus took a drink of his steaming violet wine.
"The problem is Elikar kept on and on about that blasted strap, and people started talking since he was under your protection and you two rode off together like that. Stormfather only knows how they could think you would try to have Elikar assassinated. You can barely bring yourself to kill Parshendi these days."
Sadeus stuffed a small piece of toasted bread in his mouth, then moved to walk away. Dalinar caught him by the arm again.
I owe you a debt. I shouldn't have treated you as I have these 6 years."
Sadeus rolled his eyes, chewing his bread.
"This wasn't for you alone. So long as everyone thought you were behind the attempt, nobody would figure out who really tried to have Elikar killed. And someone did, Dalinar. I don't accept 8 gemstones cracking in one fight. The strap alone would have been a ridiculous way to attempt an assassination, but with weakened shard plate, I'm half tempted to believe that the surprise arrival of the Chasm Fiend was orchestrated too. How someone would manage that, though, I have no idea."
"And the talk of me being framed?" Dalinar asked.
"Mostly to give the others something to gossip about while I sort through what's really happening."
Sadeus looked down at Dalinar's hand on his arm.
"Would you let go?"
Dalinar released his grip. Sadeus set down his plate, straightening his robe and dusting off the shoulder.
"I haven't given up on you yet, Dalinar. I'm probably going to need you before this is all through. I do have to say, though, I don't know what to make of you lately. That talk of you wanting to abandon the Vengeance Pact. Is there any truth to that?"
"I mentioned it in confidence to Elikar as a means of exploring options. So yes, there's truth to it, if you must know. I'm tired of this fighting. I'm tired of these planes, of being away from civilization, of killing Parshendi a handful at a time. However, I've given up on getting us to retreat. Instead, I want to win. But the High Princes won't listen. They all assume that I'm trying to dominate them with some crafty trick."
Sadeus snorted.
"You'd sooner punch a man in the face than stab him in the back. Blessedly straightforward."
"Ally with me,"
Dalinar said after him. Sadeus froze.
"You know I'm not going to betray you, Sadeus," Dalinar said. "You trust me as the others never can. Try what I've been trying to get the other High Princes to agree to. Jointly assault plateaus with me."
"Won't work," Sadeus said. "There's no reason to bring more than one army on an assault. I leave half my troops behind each time as it is. There isn't room for more to maneuver."
"Yes, but think," Dalinar said. "What if we tried new tactics?
Your quick bridge crews are fast, but my troops are stronger. What if you pushed quickly to a plateau with an advance force to hold off the Parshendi? You could hold until my stronger but slower forces arrive.
That gave Sadeus pause.
It could mean a short blade, Sadeus.
Sadeus's eyes grew hungry.
I know you've fought Parshendi shardbearers, Dalinar said, seizing on that thread. But you've lost. Without a blade, you're at a disadvantage.
Parshendi shardbearers had a habit of escaping after entering battles. Regular spearmen couldn't kill one, of course. It took a shardbearer to kill a shardbearer.
I've slain two in the past. I don't often have the opportunity, however, because I can't get to the plateaus quickly enough. You can. Together we can win more often, and I can get you a blade. We can do this, Sadeus. Together. Like the old days.
The old days,
he said idly.
I'd like to see the Blackthorn in battle again. How would we split the gem hearts?
2/3 to you, Dalinar said, as you've got twice as good a record at winning assaults as I have. Sadeus looked thoughtful.
And the shard blades?
If we find a shard bearer, Adolin and I will take him. You win the blade.
He raised a finger.
But I win the plate, to give to my son, Renarin.
The invalid?
What would you care? Dalinar said. You already have plate.
Sadeus, this could mean winning the war. If we start to work together, we could bring the others in, prepare for a large-scale assault.
Storms, we might not even need that. We two have the largest armies.
If we could find a way to catch the Parshendi on a large enough plateau with the bulk of our troops, surrounding them so they couldn't escape, we might be able to damage their forces enough to bring an end to this all.
Sadeus mulled it over. Then he shrugged. Very well. Send me details via messenger. But do it later. I've already missed too much of tonight's feast.
Fifty-five. An Emerald Brome. A woman sits and scratches out her own eyes. Daughter of kings and winds, the Vandal. Dated Palahevan, 1173. 73 seconds pre-death. Subject, a beggar of some renown, known for his elegant songs. 1 week after losing Dunny, Kaladin stood on another plateau watching a battle proceed. This time, however, he didn't have to save the dying. They'd actually arrived before the Parshendi, a rare but welcome event. Sadeus's army was now holding out at the center of the plateau, protecting the chrysalis while some of his soldiers cut into it. The Parshendi kept leaping over the line and attacking the men working on the chrysalis.
He's getting surrounded, Kaladin thought.
It didn't look good, which would mean a miserable return trip. Sadeus's men were bad enough when, arriving second, they were rebuffed. Losing the gem heart after arriving first would leave them even more frustrated.
Kaladin,
a voice said. Kaladin spun to see Rock trotting up. Was someone wounded?
Have you seen this thing?
The Horn-Eater pointed. Kaladin turned, following his gesture. Another army was approaching on an adjacent plateau. Kaladin raised eyebrows. The banners flapped blue, and the soldiers were obviously Alethi.
A little late, aren't they?
Moash asked, standing beside Kaladin.
It happens, Kaladin said.
Occasionally another high prince would arrive after Sadeus got to the plateau. More often Sadeus arrived first, and the other Alethi army had to turn around. Usually they didn't get this close before doing so.
That's the standard of Dalinar Kolin, Scar said, joining them.
Dalinar,
Moash said appreciatively.
They say he doesn't use bridgemen.
How does he cross the chasms, then?
Kaladin asked. The answer soon became obvious. This new army had enormous siege tower-like bridges pulled by Chulls. They rumbled across the uneven plateaus, often having to pick their way around rifts in the stone.
They must be terribly slow, Kaladin thought. But in trade, the army wouldn't have to approach the chasm while being fired on. They could hide behind those bridges.
Dalinar Kolin, Moash said. I say he's a true Light Eyes, like the men from the old days. A man of honor and of oaths.
Kaladin snorted.
I've seen plenty of Light Eyes with that same reputation, and I've been disappointed by them every time. I'll tell you about Brightlord Amaram sometime.
Amaram? Scar asked. The Shardbearer?
You've heard of that? Kaladin asked.
Sure, Scar said. He's supposed to be on his way here. Everyone's talking about it in the taverns.
Were you with him when he won his shards?
No, Kaladin said softly. Nobody was. Dalinar Kolin's army approached across the plateau to the south. Amazingly, Dalinar's army came right up to the battlefield plateau.
He's attacking? Moash said, scratching his head.
Maybe he figures that Sadeas will lose and wants to take a stab at it after he retreats.
No, Kaladin said, frowning. He's joining the battle.
The Parshendi army sent over some archers to fire on Dalinar's army, but their arrows bounced off the chulls without causing any harm. A group of soldiers unhooked the bridges and pushed them into place while Dalinar's archers set up and exchanged fire with the Parshendi.
Does it seem Sadeas took fewer soldiers with him this run?
Sigzil asked, joining the group watching Dalinar's army.
Perhaps he planned for this.
Could be why he was willing to commit like he did, letting himself get surrounded. The bridges could be cranked to lower and extend. There was some marvelous engineering at work. As they began to work, something decidedly strange happened. Two shardbearers, likely Dalinar and his son, leaped across the chasm and began attacking the Parshendi. The distraction let the soldiers get the large bridges into place, and some heavy cavalry charged across to help. It was a completely different method of doing a bridge assault, and Kaladin found himself considering the implications.
He really is joining the battle, Moash said. I think they're going to work together.
It's bound to be more effective, Kaladin said. I'm surprised they haven't tried it before. Teft snorted.
That's because you don't understand how Light Eyes think. High princes don't just want to win the battle. They want to win it by themselves.
I wish I'd been recruited in his army instead, Moash said, almost reverent. The soldiers' armor gleamed, their ranks obviously well-practiced. Dalinar, the Blackthorn, had done an even better job than Amaram at cultivating a reputation for honesty. People knew of him all the way back in Hearthstone, but Kaladin understood the kinds of corruption a well-polished breastplate could hide.
Though, he thought, that man who protected the whore on the street, he wore blue. Adolin, Dalinar's son. He seemed genuinely selfless in his defense of the woman.
Kaladin set his jaw, casting aside those doubts. He would not be taken in again. He would not. The fighting grew brutal for a short time, but the Parshendi were overwhelmed, smashed between two opposing forces. Soon, Kaladin's team led a victorious group of soldiers back to the camps for celebration. Kaladin rolled the sphere between his fingers. The otherwise pure glass had cooled with a thin line of bubbles permanently frozen along one side. The bubbles were tiny spheres of their own, catching light. He was on chasm scavenging duty. They'd gotten back from the plateau assault so quickly that Hashal, in defiance of logic or mercy, had sent them down into the chasm that very day. Kaladin continued to turn the sphere in his fingers. Hanging in the very center of it was a large emerald, cut in a round shape, with dozens of tiny facets along the sides. A small rim of suspended bubbles clung to the side of the gemstone, as if longing to be near its brilliance. Bright, crystalline green stormlight shone from inside the glass, lighting Kaladin's fingers. An emerald brome, the highest denomination of sphere, worth hundreds of lesser spheres. To Bridgman, this was a fortune. A strangely distant one, for spending it was impossible. Kaladin thought he could see some of the storm's tempest inside that rock. The light was like... it was like part of the storm, captured by the emerald. The light wasn't perfectly steady. It just seemed that way compared with the flickering of candles, torches, or lamps. Holding it close, Kaladin could see the light swirling, raging. "What do we do with it?" Moash asked, from Kaladin's side. Rock stood at Kaladin's other side. The sky was overcast, making it darker than usual here at the bottom. The cold weather of late had drawn back to spring, though it was uncomfortably chilly. The men worked efficiently, quickly gathering spears, armor, boots, and spheres from the dead. Because of the short time given them, and because of the exhausting bridge run earlier, Kaladin had decided to forego spear practice for the day. They'd load up on salvage instead and stow some of it down beneath to be used for avoiding punishment next time. As they'd worked, they'd found a light-eyed officer. He had been quite wealthy. This single emerald brome was worth what a Bridgman slave would make in 200 days. In the same pouch with it, they found a collection of chips and marks that totaled slightly more than another emerald brome. Wealth. A fortune. Simply pocket change to a light eyes. "With this we could feed those wounded Bridgmen for months," Moash said. "We could buy all the medical supplies we could want. Stormfather, we could probably bribe the camp's perimeter guards to let us sneak away."
"This thing will not happen," Rock said. "It is impossible to get spheres out of the chasms."
"We could swallow them," Moash said.
"You would choke. Spheres are too big, eh?"
"I'll bet I could do it," Moash said. His eyes glittered, reflecting the verdant stormlight. "That's more money than I've ever seen. It's worth the risk." "Swallowing won't work," Kaladin said. "You think those guards who watch us in the latrines are there to keep us from fleeing? I'll bet some sodden parchment has to go through our droppings, and I've seen them keep record of who visits and how often. We aren't the first to think of swallowing spheres." Moash hesitated, then sighed, crestfallen. "You're probably right. Storm you, but you are. But we can't just give it to them, can we?" "Yes, we can," Kaladin said, closing his fist around the sphere. The glow was bright enough to make his hand shine. "We'd never be able to spend it. A Bridgman with a full brome? It would give us away." "But," Moash began. "We'll give it to them, Moash." Then he held up the pouch containing the other spheres. "But we find a way to keep these." Rock nodded.
"Yes. If we give up this expensive sphere, they will think us honest, eh? It will disguise the theft. And they will even give us small reward. But how can we do this thing, keeping the pouch?"
"I'm working on that," Kaladin said. "Work fast, then," Moash said, glancing at Kaladin's torch, rammed between two rocks at the side of the chasm. "We'll need to head back up soon." Kaladin opened his hand and rolled the emerald sphere between his fingers. "How?" "Have you ever seen anything so beautiful?" Moash asked, staring at the emerald. "It's just a sphere," Kaladin said absently. "A tool. I once held a goblet full of 100 diamond bromes and was told they were mine. Since I never got to spend them, they were as good as worthless."
100 diamonds? Moash asked. "Where? How?"
Kaladin closed his mouth, cursing himself. "I shouldn't keep mentioning things like that." "Go on," he said, tucking the emerald brome back into the black pouch. "We need to be quick." Moash sighed, but Rock thumped him on the back good-naturedly, and they joined the rest of the Bridgemen. Rock and Lopin, using Syl's directions, had led them to a large mass of corpses in red and brown uniforms. He didn't know which High Prince's men they were, but the bodies were pretty fresh. There were no Parshendi among them. Kaladin glanced to the side, where Shen, the Parshman Bridgeman, worked. Quiet, obedient, stalwart. Teft still didn't trust him. A part of Kaladin was glad for that. Syl landed on the wall beside him, standing with her feet planted against the surface and looking up at the sky.
Think, Kaladin told himself. How do we keep these spheres? There has to be a way.
But each possibility seemed too much of a risk. If they were caught stealing, they'd probably be given a different work detail. Kaladin wasn't willing to risk that. Silent green lifespren began to fade into existence around him, bobbing around the moss and aspers. A few furl blooms opened up fronds of red and yellow beside his head. Kaladin had thought again and again about Dunny's death. Bridge 4 was not safe. True, they'd lost a remarkably small number of men lately, but they were still dwindling, and each bridge run was a chance for total disaster. All it took was one time, with the Parshendi focusing on them. Lose 3 or 4 men and they'd topple. The waves of arrows would redouble, cutting every one of them down. It was the same old problem, the one Kaladin had beaten his head against day after day. How did you protect bridgemen when everyone wanted them exposed and endangered?
Hey, Sig,
Maps said, walking by carrying an armload of spears.
You're a world singer, right?
Maps had grown increasingly friendly in the last few weeks, and had proven good at getting the others talking. The balding man reminded Kaladin of an innkeeper, always quick to make his patrons feel at ease. Sigzel, who was pulling the boots off a line of corpses, gave Kaladin a straight-lipped glance that seemed to say, "This is your fault." He didn't like that others had discovered he was a world singer.
"Why don't you give us a tale?"
Map said, setting down his armload.
"Help us pass the time."
"I am not a foolish gesture or storyteller," Sigzel said, yanking off a boot. "I do not give tales. I spread knowledge of cultures, peoples, thoughts, and dreams. I bring peace through understanding. It is the holy charge my order received from the heralds themselves."
"Well, why not start spreading, then?"
Maps said, standing and wiping his hands on his trousers. Sigzel sighed audibly.
"Very well. What is it you wish to hear about?"
"I don't know. Something interesting." "Tell us about Bright King Alizansi and the 100-ship fleet," Layton called.
"I am not a storyteller," Sigzel repeated. "I speak of nations and peoples, not tavern stories. I—"
"Is there a place where people live in gorges in the ground?" Kaladin said. "A city built in an enormous complex of lines, all set into the rock as if carved there."
"Sessa Malix Dar,"
Sigzel said, nodding, pulling off another boot.
"Yes. It is the capital of the kingdom of Imul, and is one of the most ancient cities in the world. It is said that the city, and indeed the kingdom, were named by Yezrian himself."
"Yezrian?"
Malop said, standing and scratching his head.
"Who's that?"
Malop was a thick-haired fellow with a bushy black beard and a glyph-ward tattoo on each hand. He also wasn't the brightest sphere in the goblet, so to speak.
"You call him the Stormfather here in Alethkar," Sigzel said. "Or Yezereza Ilin. He was king of the heralds, master of the storms, bringer of water and life, known for his fury and his temper, but also for his mercy."
"Oh,"
Malop said.
"Tell me more of the city," Kaladin said. "Sessa Malix Dar. It is, indeed, built in giant troughs. The pattern is quite amazing. It protects against high storms, as each trough has a lip at the side, keeping water from streaming in off the stone plain around it.
that mixed with a drainage system of cracks protects the city from flooding. The people there are known for their expert creme pottery. The city is a major waypoint in the southwest. The Emuli are a certain tribe of the Eskarki people, and they're ethnically Makabaki, dark-skinned, like myself. Their kingdom borders on my own, and I visited there many times in my youth. It is a wondrous place, filled with exotic travelers. Sigzel grew more relaxed as he continued to talk. Their legal system is very lenient toward foreigners. A man who is not of their nationality cannot own a home or shop, but when you visit, you are treated as a relative who has traveled from afar to be shown all kindness and leniency. A foreigner can take dinner at any residence he calls upon, assuming he is respectful, and offers a gift of fruit. The people are most interested in exotic fruits. They worship Yezrian, though they don't accept him as a figure from the Voran religion. They name him the only god.
The heralds aren't gods, Teft scoffed.
To you, they aren't, Sigzel said. Others regard them differently. The Emuli have what your scholars like to call a splinter religion, containing some Voran ideas. But to the Emuli, you would be the splinter religion.
Sigzel seemed to find that amusing, though Teft just scowled. Sigzel continued in more and more detail, talking of the flowing gowns and head wraps of the Emuli women, the robes favored by the men, the taste of the food, salty, and the way of greeting an old friend, by holding the left forefinger to the forehead and bowing in respect. Sigzel knew an impressive amount about them. Kaladin noticed him smiling wistfully at times, probably recalling his travels. The details were interesting, but Kaladin was more taken aback by the fact that this city, which he had flown over in his dream weeks ago, was actually real, and he could no longer ignore the strange speed at which he recovered from wounds. Something odd was happening to him, something supernatural. What if it was related to the fact that everyone around him always seemed to die? He knelt down to begin rifling the pockets of the dead men, a duty the other bridgemen avoided. Spheres, knives, and other useful objects were kept. Personal mementos, like unburned prayers, were left with the bodies. He found a few zircon chips, which he added to the pouch. Maybe Moash was right. If they could get this money out, could they bribe their way free of the city? That would certainly be safer than fighting. So why was he so insistent on teaching the bridgemen to fight? Why hadn't he given any thought to sneaking the bridgemen out? He had lost Dalet and the others of his original squad in Amaram's army. Did he think to compensate for that by training a new group of spearmen? Was this about saving men he'd grown to love, or was it just about proving something to himself? His experience told him that men who could not fight were at a severe disadvantage in this world of war and storms. Perhaps sneaking out would have been the better option, but he knew little of stealth. Besides, if they sneaked away, Sadius would send troops after them. Trouble would track them down. Whatever their path, the bridgemen would have to kill to remain free. He squeezed his eyes shut, remembering one of his escape attempts, when he'd kept his fellow slaves free for an entire week, hiding in the wilderness. They'd finally been caught by their master's hunters. That was when he'd lost Nalma.
None of that has to do with saving them here and now, Kaladin told himself. I need these spheres.
Sigzel was still talking about the Emuli.
To them, the world singer said. The need to strike a man personally is crass. They wage war in the opposite way from you, Alethi. The sword is not a weapon for a leader. A halberd is better, then a spear, and best of all, a bow and arrow.
Kaladin pulled another handful of spheres, sky chips, from a soldier's pocket. They were stuck to an aged hunk of sow's cheese, fragrant and moldy. He grimaced, picking the spheres out and washing them in a puddle.
Spears? Used by Light Eyes? Dre said. That's ridiculous.
Why? Sigzel said, sounding offended. I find the Emuliwe to be interesting. In some countries, it is seen as displeasing to fight at all. To the Shin, for instance, if you must fight a man, then you have already failed. Killing is, at best, a brutish way of solving problems.
You're not going to be like Rock and refuse to fight, are you? Scar asked, shooting a barely veiled glare at the Horn Eater. Rock sniffed and turned his back on the shorter man, kneeling down to shove boots into a large sack.
No, Sigzel said. I think we can all agree that other methods have failed. Perhaps if my master knew I still lived. But no. That is foolish. Yes, I will fight. And if I have to, the spear seems a favorable weapon, though I honestly would prefer to put more distance between myself and my enemies.
Kaladin frowned.
You mean with a bow?
Sigzel nodded.
Among my people, the bow is a noble weapon.
Do you know how to use one?
Alas, no, Sigzel said. I would have mentioned it before now if I had such proficiency.
Kaladin stood up, opening the pouch and depositing the spheres in with the others.
Were there any bows among the bodies?
The men glanced at each other, several of them shaking heads.
Storm it, Kaladin thought.
The seed of an idea had begun to sprout in his mind, but that killed it.
Gather up some of those spears, he said. Set them aside. We'll need them for training.
But we have to turn them in, Malop said.
Not if we don't take them with us up out of the chasm, Kaladin said.
Each time we come scavenging, we'll save a few spears and stash them down here. It shouldn't take long to gather enough to practice with.
How will we get them out when it's time to escape?
Teft asked, rubbing his chin.
Spears left down here won't do these lads much good once the real fighting starts.
I'll find a way to get them up, Kaladin said.
You say things like that a lot, Scar noted.
Leave off, Scar, Moash said. He knows what he's doing.
Kaladin blinked. Had Moash just defended him? Scar flushed.
I didn't mean it like that, Kaladin. I'm just asking, that's all.
I understand.
Kaladin trailed off as Syl flitted down into the chasm in the form of a curling ribbon. She landed on a rock outcropping on the wall, taking on her female form.
I found another group of bodies. They're mostly Parshendi.
Any bows? Kaladin asked.
Several of the bridgemen gawked at him until they saw him staring into the air. Then they nodded knowingly to one another.
I think so, Syl said. It's just down this way. Not too far.
The bridgemen had mostly finished with these bodies.
Gather up the things, Kaladin said. I've found us another place to scavenge. We need to gather as much as we can, then stash some in a chasm where it has a good chance of not being washed away.
The bridgemen picked up their findings, slinging sacks over their shoulders and each man hefting a spear or two. Within moments, they headed down the dank chasm bottom, following Syl. They passed clefts in the ancient rock walls where old, storm-washed bones had gotten lodged, creating a mound of moss-covered femurs, tibia, skulls, and ribs. There wasn't much salvage among them. After about a quarter hour, they came to the place Syl had found. A scattered group of Parshendi dead lay in heaps, mixed with the occasional Alethi in blue. Kaladin knelt beside one of the human bodies. He recognized Dalinar Kolin's stylized glyph pair sewn on the coat. Why had Dalinar's army joined Satius's in battle? What had changed? Kaladin pointed for the men to begin scavenging from the Alethi while he walked over to one of the Parshendi corpses. It was much fresher than Dalinar's man. They didn't find nearly as many Parshendi corpses as they did Alethi. Not only were there fewer of them in any given battle, but they were less likely to fall to their deaths into the chasms. Sigzel also guessed that their bodies were more dense than human ones, and didn't float or wash away as easily. Kaladin rolled the body onto its side, and the action elicited a sudden hiss from the back of the group of bridgemen. Kaladin turned to see Shen pushing forward in an uncharacteristic display of passion. Teft moved quickly, grabbing Shen from behind, placing him in a chokehold. The other bridgemen stood aghast, though several fell into their stances by reflex. Shen struggled weakly against Teft's grip. The Parshman looked different from his dead cousins. Close together, the differences were much more obvious. Shen, like most Parshmen, was short and a little plump. Stout, strong, but not threatening. The corpse at Kaladin's feet, however, was muscled and built like a horn-eater, easily as tall as Kaladin and far broader at the shoulders. While both had the marbled skin, the Parshendi had those strange deep red growths of armor on the head, chest, arms, and legs. "Let him go," Kaladin said, curious. Teft glanced at him, then reluctantly did as commanded. Shen scrambled over the uneven ground and gently but firmly pushed Kaladin away from the corpse. Shen stood back as if protecting it from Kaladin.
"This thing," Rock noted, stepping up beside Kaladin. "He has done it before. When Lopin and I take him scavenging."
"He's protective of the Parshendi bodies, Goncho," Lopin added. "Like he'd stab you 100 times for moving one, sure."
"They're all like that," Sigzel said from behind. Kaladin turned, raising an eyebrow. "Parshman workers," Sigzel explained. "They're allowed to care for their own dead. It's one of the few things they seem passionate about. They grow irate if anyone else handles the bodies. They wrap them in linen and carry them out into the wilderness, and leave them on slabs of stone." Kaladin regarded Shen. "I wonder..."
"Scavenge from the Parshendi," Kaladin said to his men. "Teft, you'll probably have to hold Shen the whole time. I can't have him trying to stop us."
Teft shot Kaladin a suffering glance. He still thought they should set Shen at the front of the bridge and let him die. But he did as told, pushing Shen away and getting Moash's help to hold him.
"And men," Kaladin noted, "be respectful of the dead."
"They're Parshendi," Layton objected.
"I know," Kaladin said. "But it bothers Shen. He's one of us. So let's keep his irritation to a minimum."
The Parshman lowered his arms reluctantly and let Teft and Moash pull him away. He seemed resigned. Parshmen were slow of thought. How much did Shen comprehend?
"Didn't you wish to find a bow?" Sigzel asked,
kneeling and slipping a horned Parshendi shortbow out from underneath the body.
"The bowstring is gone."
"There's another in this fellow's pouch,"
Maps said, pulling something out of another Parshendi corpse's belt pouch.
"Might still be good."
Kaladin accepted the weapon in string.
"Does anyone know how to use one of these?"
The bridgemen glanced at one another. Bows were useless for hunting most shell beasts. Slings worked far better. The bow was really only good for killing other men. Kaladin glanced at Teft, who shook his head. He hadn't been trained on a bow. Neither had Kaladin.
"It's simple,"
Rock said, rolling over a Parshendi corpse.
"Put arrow on string, pull away from self, pull very hard, let go."
"I doubt it will be that easy," Kaladin said.
"We barely have time to train the lads in the spear, Kaladin," Teft said. "You mean to teach some of them the bow as well? And without a teacher who can use one himself?"
Kaladin didn't respond. He tucked the bow and string away in his bag, added a few arrows, then helped the others. An hour later, they marched through the chasms toward the ladder, their torches sputtering, dusk approaching. The darker it grew, the more unpleasant the chasms became. Shadows deepened and distant sounds, water dripping, rocks falling, wind calling, took on an ominous cast. Kaladin rounded a corner and a group of many-legged kremlings scuttled along the wall and slipped into a fissure. Conversation was subdued, and Kaladin didn't take part. Occasionally, he glanced over his shoulder toward Shen. The silent Parshman walked head down. Robbing the Parshendi corpses had seriously disturbed him.
I can use that, Kaladin thought. But dare I? It would be a risk. A great one.
He had already been sentenced once for upsetting the balance of the chasm battles.
First the spheres, he thought.
Getting the spheres out would mean he might be able to get out other items. Eventually, he saw a shadow above, spanning the chasm. They had reached the first of the permanent bridges. Kaladin walked with the others a little further until they reached a place where the chasm floor was closer to the top of the plateaus above. He stopped here. The bridgemen gathered around him.
Sigzil, Kaladin said, pointing. You know something about bows? How hard do you think it would be to hit that bridge with an arrow?
I've occasionally held a bow, Kaladin, but I would not call myself an expert. It shouldn't be too hard, I'd imagine. The distance is, what, 50 feet?
What's the point? Moash asked.
Kaladin pulled out the pouch full of spheres, then raised an eyebrow at them.
We tie the bag to the arrow, then launch it up so that it sticks to the bottom of the bridge. Then, when we're on a bridge run, Lopin and Dabid can hang back to get a drink near that bridge up there. They reach under the wood and pull the arrow off. We get the spheres.
Teft whistled.
Clever. We could get all of the spheres, Moash said eagerly. Even the...
No, Kaladin said firmly. The lesser ones will be dangerous enough. People might begin wondering where bridgemen are getting so much money.
He would have to buy his supplies from several different apothecaries to hide his influx of money. Moash looked crestfallen, but the other bridgemen were eager.
Who wants to try? Kaladin asked. Maybe we should shoot a few practice shots first, then try with the bag. Sigzil?
I don't know if I want this on me, Sigzil said. Maybe you should try, Teft.
Teft rubbed his chin.
Sure, I guess. How hard can it be?
How hard? Rock asked suddenly.
Kaladin glanced to the side. Rock stood at the back of the group, though his height made him easy to see. He had his arms folded.
How hard, Teft? Rock continued. 50 feet is not too far, but is not easy shot. And to do it with bag of heavy spheres tied to it? Ha! You also need to get arrow close to the side of bridge, so Lopin can reach it. If you miss with this thing, you could lose all spheres. And what if scouts near bridges above see arrow come from chasm? Will they think it suspicious, eh?
Kaladin eyed the horn eater. Is simple, he'd said. Point away from self, let go.
Well, Kaladin said, watching Rock from the corner of his eye. I guess we'll just have to take that chance. Without these spheres, the wounded die.
We could wait until the next bridge run, Teft said. Tie a rope to the bridge and toss it over, then tie the bag to it next time.
50 feet of rope, Kaladin said flatly. It would draw enough attention to buy something like that.
Nah, Gancho, Lopin said. I have a cousin who works in a place that sells rope. I could get some for you easy with money.
Perhaps, Kaladin said. But you'd still have to hide it in the litter, then hang it down into the chasm without anyone seeing. And to leave it dangling there for several days? It would be noticed.
The others nodded. Rock seemed very uncomfortable. Sighing, Kaladin took out the bow and several arrows.
We'll just have to chance this.
Teft, why don't you...
Oh, Kali Kalin's ghost, Rock muttered. Here, give me bow.
He shoved his way through the bridgeman, taking the bow from Kaladin. Kaladin hid a smile. Rock glanced upward, judging the distance in the waning light. He strung the bowstring, then held out a hand. Kaladin handed him an arrow. He leveled the bow back down the chasm and launched. The arrow flew, swiftly, clattering against chasm walls. Rock nodded to himself, then pointed at Kaladin's pouch.
We take only 5 spheres, Rock said.
Any more would be too heavy. He's crazy to try with even five. Air-sick lowlanders.
Kaladin smiled, then counted out five sapphire marks, together about 2.5 months' worth of pay for a bridgeman, and placed them in a spare pouch. He handed that to Rock, who pulled out a knife and dug a notch into the arrow's wood next to the arrowhead. Scar folded his arms and leaned against the mossy wall.
This is stealing, you know.
Yes, Kaladin said, watching Rock. And I don't feel the least bit bad about it. Do you?
Not at all, Scar said, grinning. I figure once someone is trying to get you killed, all expectations of your loyalty are tossed to the storm. But if someone were to go to Gaz...
The other bridgeman suddenly grew nervous, and more than a few eyes darted toward Shen, though Kaladin could see that Scar wasn't thinking of the Parshmen. If one of the bridgemen were to betray the rest of them, he might earn himself a reward.
Maybe we should post a watch, Dre said. You know, make sure nobody sneaks off to talk to Gaz.
We'll do no such thing, Kaladin said. What are we going to do? Lock ourselves in the barrack, so suspicious of each other that we never get anything done?
He shook his head. No. This is just one more danger. It's a real one, but we can't waste energy spying on each other. So we keep on going. Scar didn't look convinced.
We're Bridge Four, Kaladin said firmly. We've faced death together. We have to trust each other. You can't run into battle wondering if your companions are going to switch sides suddenly.
He met the eyes of each man in turn.
I trust you. All of you. We'll make it through this, and we'll do it together.
There were several nods. Scar seemed placated. Rock finished his work cutting the arrow, then proceeded to tie the pouch tightly around the shaft. Syl still sat on Kaladin's shoulder.
You want me to watch the others? Make sure nobody does what Scar thinks they might?
Kaladin hesitated, then nodded. Best to be safe. He just didn't want the men to have to think that way. Rock hefted the arrow, judging the weight.
Near impossible shot, he complained.
Then in a smooth motion, he knocked the arrow and drew to his cheek, positioning himself directly beneath the bridge. The small pouch hung down, dangling against the wood of the arrow. The bridgemen held their breath. Rock loosed. The arrow streaked up the side of the chasm wall, almost too fast to follow. A faint click sounded as arrow met wood, and Kaladin held his breath. But the arrow did not pull free. It remained hanging there, precious spheres tied to its shaft, right next to the side of the bridge where it could be reached. Kaladin clapped Rock on the shoulder as the bridgeman cheered him. Rock eyed Kaladin.
I will not use bow to fight. You must know this thing. I promise, Kaladin said. I'll take you if you agree, but I won't force you. I will not fight, Rock said. It's not my place.
He glanced up at the spheres, then smiled faintly.
But shooting bridge is all right.
How did you learn? Kaladin asked.
It's secret, Rock said firmly. Take bow. Bother me no more.
All right, Kaladin said, accepting the bow. But I don't know if I can promise not to bother you. I may need a few more shots in the future. He eyed Lopin. You really think you can buy some rope without drawing attention? Lopin lounged back against the wall.
My cousins never failed me.
How many cousins do you have, anyway? Earless Jax asked.
A man can never have enough cousins, Lopin said.
Well, we need that rope,
Kaladin said, the plan beginning to sprout in his mind.
Do it, Lopin. I'll make change from those spheres above to pay for it.
Fifty-six. That storming book.
Light grows so distant. The storm never stops. I am broken, and all around me have died. I weep for the end of all things. He has won.
Oh, he has beaten us.
Dated Palahakev, 1173. 16 seconds pre-death. Subject, a Thalen sailor. Delanor fought, the thrill pulsing within him, swinging his shard blade from atop Gallant's back. Around him, Parshendi fell with eyes burning black. They came at him in pairs, each team trying to hit him from a different direction, keeping him busy and, they hoped, disoriented. If a pair could rush at him while he was distracted, they might be able to shove him off his mount. Those axes and maces, swung repeatedly, could crack his plate. It was a very costly tactic. Corpses lay scattered around Dalinar. But when fighting against a shard-bearer, every tactic was costly. Dalinar kept Gallant moving, dancing from side to side, swinging his blade in broad sweeps. He stayed just a little ahead of his line of men. A shard-bearer needed space to fight. The blades were so long that hurting one's companions was a real danger. His honor guard would approach only if he fell or encountered trouble. The thrill excited him, strengthened him. He hadn't experienced the weakness again, the nausea he had on the battlefield that day weeks ago. Perhaps he'd been worried about nothing. He turned Gallant just in time to confront two pairs of Parshendi coming at him from behind, singing softly. He directed Gallant with his knees, performing an expert sweeping side swing, cutting through the necks of two Parshendi, then the arm of a third. Eyes burned out in the first two, and they collapsed. The third dropped his weapon from a hand that grew suddenly lifeless, flopping down, its nerves all severed. The fourth member of that squad scrambled away, glaring at Dalinar. This was one of the Parshendi who didn't wear a beard, and it seemed that there was something odd about his face. The cheek structure was just a little off. Was that a woman? Dalinar thought with amazement. It couldn't have been, could it?